Good morning, everybody. You look wonderfully rested and full of energy and vitality and thoughtfulness for great questions and conversations and things to come. Yesterday, we had a great day, and one thing that we omitted was to speak of this book, a great book that, oops, upside down, that Nicholas Dennis has written about Graham Greene's library, and the library is of crucial importance, and copies are available at the table, is that right? Oh, Graham's own contribution, perfect. So strongly, strongly recommended. I think it's one of the parts of Graham Greene's scholarship that we haven't really done properly. It's the annotations in the library that we, that Nicholas spoke of yesterday. So extremely important stuff. And I'm very proud of this copy because he signed it for me and said something nice. Our first speaker today is Kevin Ruane, who you may recall from earlier festivals. So this is your first festival. We're really crazy happy to have you here. Come back again, come back forever. But if you've been here before, you probably know Kevin Ruane. He's a professor of modern history at Canterbury Christ Church University. He's written many books. He knows everything there is to know about atomic bombs and Winston Churchill and all sorts of things like that. But he's been moving into cultural history and really shaming those of us who have been doing it for a while. And he's going to speak to us today on the film we watched last night and its successor. So at that point, I give you the amazing Kevin Ruane.
Well, if you've been coming to this festival for a while, you'll know what a lovely man Richard Greene is, and he's just proved it with that generous introduction. Yeah, this is my fourth time speaking at this most warm and welcoming of festivals, so it's great to be back. And if you've attended my previous talks, well, hello again. Good to see you. You'll know that I'm not a literature specialist. I'm really a historian, principally of the Cold War. But I studied literature at university alongside history. Literature is an abiding passion in my life, and I've always been drawn to the blending of history and literature, the dovetailing of fact and fiction. I'm kind of into that. I don't mean historical fiction, by the way, in the Hilary Mantel mold, but how history can be reflected or refracted by novelists. Knowingly or unknowingly, consciously or unconsciously, novelists like Graham Greene can be chroniclers and even interpreters of the past. And that's kind of where my history and literature thing comes together. Actually, I know it's a Graham Greene festival. Let me give you a non-Graham Greene first example of what I mean. Now, I used to teach a module on Britain and the lead up to the Second World War. And alongside getting my students to read lots of history, as you'd expect, I would get them to read George Orwell's novel, Coming Up for Air, which was published in 1939. Because to my mind, Orwell captures better than any history book or documentary that I could show my students. Are you okay? This novel captures better that weird, darkening, morbid atmosphere gripping Britain in the late 1930s, this terrible collective fear of another cataclysm on the horizon, just 20 years on from the end of the Great War, the war that was meant to end all wars. Now, by reading this novel, my history students began to engage emotionally with the 1930s. And if they began to get the 30s emotionally, they began to get it as historians. As for Graham Greene, well, for Cold War culture historians such as I am becoming, I think he gives fantastic value with his 1955 Vietnam set novel, The Quiet American, probably paying the best dividends of all, if you ask me. Now, that said, I'm not going to focus on the novel as such. I'm much more interested this morning in the 1958 movie, Wherever He Walked, All Hell Broke Loose. Well, discuss, having seen the film last night, many of you. This film, like the novel that gave birth to it, offers me, as a Cold War culture historian these days, a wonderful Cold War primary source, a portal into the Cold War culture, particularly in America or Anglo-America in the 1950s. Now, you will know, if you were at last night's screening, from Mike, where is Mike? Mike. From Mike's gem of a miniature introduction, that Graham Greene hated this film. Absolutely loathed and detested it. But why did he hate it so much? Well, answering that question is going to be my task this morning. And along the way, I'm going to mix into my mixing bowl. I'm going to chuck in some literature. I'm going to sprinkle in cinema. I'm going to sprinkle in some history. Now, despite the billing, I'm going to focus primarily on this 1958 film. I am going to nod to the 2002 version, which was directed by the Australian Philip Noyce, and which I think Graham Greene would have liked better because it is much more faithful to the political thrust of his novel. But it's this movie that Graham Greene saw, it's this one he commented on in his lifetime, and it's this one he loathed, hated, and despised. So that is going to be my primary purpose. Okay, before the film, there would have been, and there was, a novel. So come with me back now in time to June 1951. Graham Greene is bobbing around the Mediterranean on a luxury yacht. He's the guest of movie mogul Alexander Korda and friend Alexander Korda. There they are on the screen behind me. And by mid-June 51, they reach Greek waters. Last night, wrote Greene at the time, we spent in Epidaurus Bay and went up to the Greek theatre for a concert. It was very lovely. First, Mozart's Jupiter Symphony, brackets, which I liked perhaps because a faint idea for an Indochina novel stirred, close brackets. June 1951. Graham Greene had visited Indochina for the first time a few months earlier, where he witnessed firsthand the war between the French colonial forces and the Viet Minh, the communist-led nationalists under the man on the right of the screen, Ho Chi Minh. January 51. Three further extended visits would follow to Vietnam, which was the cauldron of the war, not Laos and Cambodia. Vietnam was where it was happening. Before, in 1955, his, dare I suggest, Mozart-stirred Vietnam novel was published. Now, at this stage, I think it would be helpful to offer just a bare-bones outline of the story and a little bit of historical context thrown in. I'm sorry if it's a plot spoiler, if you've not seen the movie or you've not read the novel, but there we go. Now, the setting is obviously Vietnam, but the time frame, the novel is set in 1951, 1952. And that means it coincides, it maps to Greene's first two visits to Vietnam. Now, the war that Greene witnessed had begun in 1946, with the French fighting to maintain a century, really, of colonial control in the face of the Viet Minh's push for independence. But in 1950, the Cold War comes knocking on Vietnam's door. First, newly communized China begins giving military assistance to the Viet Minh, not soldiers, but arms and ammunition and so on, and the USA begins doing the same for the French. So that by the time Greene encounters this war, the original colonial conflict is still there, but it's also morphing simultaneously into a Cold War flashpoint, a Cold War hotspot. Greene's first couple of visits, 51 and 52, also coincided, though, with a period of great French and American tension within Vietnam. Now, on the one hand, the French appreciated all the American money and the guns and the aircraft and the napalm. That's not a phenomenon for the American war later. But what the French didn't like was the flood of American military types and civilian administrators that came with the aid. The French really became paranoid, really, about the Americans taking over their war. At the same time, the Americans, as we would say in country, were the proud heirs of an anti-colonial tradition going right back, well, frankly, to 1776 and probably earlier. They were very uncomfortable working with the colonial French, even if Cold War necessity seemed to bring these two together in Southeast Asia. Now, a lot of that history I've just spouted at you is in the novel. But the story in the novel is driven by the interaction of the two main male characters. Now, my slide references the filmic version of 1958, but I am using that just to give you a visual fix. I'm still talking exclusively, really, about the novel. Now, the first key character is Thomas Fowler. There he is on the left of the screen, played in the movie by Michael Redgrave. Later, in 2002, it will be Michael Caine. So Thomas Fowler, middle-aged, cynical, opium-smoking in the novel, not a bit of opium to be seen in the film, by the way. An English journalist working in Saigon in southern Vietnam during the war. And then there is Alden Pyle, the quiet American of the novel's title, a young, idealistic, committed, cold warrior. Almost a fundamentalist cold warrior, played by Audie Murphy in the film in 1958 and by Brendan Fraser, who's made a superb comeback in the last couple of years in his acting career. Pyle in the novel claims to be with an economic mission that's connected somehow to the US legation in Saigon. But Fowler discovers his, quote, true career, unquote, Fowler's words. He's really, for want of a better word, CIA, Central Intelligence Agency, and Pyle, in the novel, is working to cultivate and arm a third force. More on that in a second, but the third person in the slide behind me is the character of Fong. In the novel, Fong is Fowler's Vietnamese mistress, whom Pyle falls in love with. In novel and film as well. But in 1958, in a piece of culturally inappropriate casting, I think even breathtaking for the 1950s, the part of the young Vietnamese woman is played by Italian-German actress, Georgia Moll. What though is a third force? That's the historian in me, in its context. What did Graham Greene mean by that? Well, in the novel, the US government, just backing the French, but the US government is evidently anxious that the French might one day quit this war, and America needed a fallback if the French weren't there anymore. They needed a third force to work with. Couldn't be force number one, France, because they could be going. Can't be force number two, the communist-led Viet Minh, no way. What about a third way, a third alternative, a Vietnamese force that America could, with, you know, sort of, without offending its conscience, support? Well, the search for a third force in the novel can hardly go on openly if you're the Americans, while the French are still fighting and dying in considerable numbers. So the search goes on secretly, and Pyle will eventually alight in the novel on this shadowy, murky figure of General Tay and his motley crew of jungle-based paramilitaries. Now, the thing about General Tay in the novel is he's anti-French and he's anti-communist. Therefore, he is ideal third force material. Let me just now point out a little bit of intriguing fact and fiction crossover. First of all, as Green acknowledged, Tay was, quote, real. Secondly, as historians acknowledge, the CIA was indeed cultivating Tay as a third force candidate in real life in 1951, 1952, when Graham Greene was first in Vietnam. The real life Trinh Minh Tay, and there he is on the screen, he looks about 12 years of age. He was second in command of the army of something called the Cao Dai, which featured prominently in one of two scenes in the movie. The Cao Dai is now a southern Vietnamese religious sect. In Graham Greene's time, it had 2 million adherents, so it's not a sort of minor sect, it's a significant thing. 2 million followers. Now, when Graham Greene turns up, early 50s, the Cao Dai is officially neutral, doesn't take sides, it isn't engaged. But in June 1951, when Graham Greene is bobbing around the Mediterranean, in June 1951, Tay here, evidently reacting against the neutralism of the Cao Dai, he breaks rank. He heads to the hills, taking 2,500 soldiers and a stockpile of weapons. He sets up a radio station, which beams out anti-French, anti-Viet Minh propaganda. He calls, thus the real life Tay, for people to join his movement, what he calls the National Resistance Front. This is all real stuff. And in January 1952, Tay's front is not squeamish about using violence. Tay will be responsible for the detonation of a deadly car bomb that goes off in the Place Garnier in downtown central Saigon. Now, that atrocity was initially blamed by the French on the Viet Minh. But Graham Greene, who was in Vietnam at the time, although he didn't witness directly this atrocity, Greene had such faith in his local intelligence network that a few months later, in the columns of Le Monde, he will out Tay, and I quote Greene, he will out him as, let me get the quote right, the chief of a third force who makes war on everyone and places high explosive bombs in the very centre of Saigon to kill innocent civilians. That's Graham Greene on the public record. Greene will go on to use that car bombing as the pivotal point of his novel a few years later, the moment when Fowler's suspicions of what Pyle is really up to are kind of borne out. In the aftermath of the blast, and I'm using a still from the film, but I'm making a novelistic point still, it gives you a little reference point. In the aftermath of the blast, Fowler is wandering around in the smoke and chaos. He finds Pyle and he shouts at him, says, you put General Tay on the map, all right? And then he points at Pyle's blood-spattered footwear. You've got the third force all over your right shoe. Hard hitting. From that moment on, Fowler in the novel is determined to do something about Pyle's political meddling, lest he cause further death and destruction. Fowler is, of course, also bitter in the novel that Pyle has wooed his mistress Fong away from him. Well, you put it all together, Fowler in the novel will indirectly but pretty effectively lure Pyle to his death at the hands of a Viet Minh assassin. Now, many of Greene's readers, when the novel came out in 1955, would have had a strong sense of the Vietnam scene, I think, because only the year before, 1954, the climactic battle of the Eight-Year War had been played out at a place called Dien Bien Phu. And that battle was front-page news. It was viral, we might almost say, these days, from mid-March 1954 through to mid-May 1954. Now, the battle was won by Ho Chi Minh and the Viet Minh, and a little bit of history housekeeping. In July 1954, a peace settlement was arrived at. Vietnam was partitioned into a Viet Minh North and a loosely still French-administered South. But the key point was there were meant to be reunification elections in 1956. The dividing line would be erased, the French would go home, and Vietnam would emerge truly united and under its own government. Now, you may well know those elections never take place. The French, who are pretty battered and disillusioned, will leave early. The United States will step in and it has to be said in violation of the neutrality clauses of the peace settlement, to launch what Washington policymakers at the time called, it was their own phrase, a nation-building project. The creation, if you like, of a separate, permanently separate, southern anti-communist state. American Cold War strategists are worried that Ho Chi Minh might well win those reunification elections in 1956. Better than to settle for half of Vietnam permanently grafted into the Western alliance in the Cold War than risk losing the whole thing. Nation building. Now, around that time, 1954-55, the Americans believed they'd finally found their third force. And it wasn't Tay and the Cowdai, that had been a false start. It was post-partition southern Vietnam's Roman Catholic community. It's around about 1.8 million people out of a population of 17 million who are predominantly Buddhist, either practicing or at least spiritually connected to Buddhism. The Americans also felt they found the leader of their third force in the man who was actually already leader of post-partition South Vietnam's government. He's on the screen there. A man called Ngo Dinh Diem. There he is over there with New York's Cardinal Francis Spellman. And he's with Spellman because Diem was an ardent Roman Catholic, really, really incredibly devout Roman Catholic. He was also, though, a fierce anti-communist and a fierce nationalist. In other words, he was made of the right stuff as far as Cold War America is concerned. And Diem would front the American nation-building project in South Vietnam. Anyway, that's the history housekeeping. The novel, The Quiet American, was published in this country in December 1955 to almost consistently admiring, rightly so, reviews. But in the USA, there was considerable anger towards the novel, and particularly the way Green had taken Pyle to, as it were, personify an American policy towards Vietnam, and maybe towards the developing world generally, that was naive, self-serving, and dangerous. Nobody liked it in America, Green remembered. Interestingly, a decade later, the mid-60s onwards, as America finds itself being drawn into its own war in Vietnam, a lot of US commentators revisited that novel. I know that Nick mentioned yesterday journalists going to Vietnam reading the novel, but other critics would read it, and in the mid-60s began to see the Pyle character as eerily prophetic. You know, Pyle seems to embody this admixture of naivety and arrogance that maybe was producing America's own entrapment. The Americans began to like it when they became involved, Green remembered. Then I got lots of nice letters from people. Well, so much for the novel. The 1958 movie was produced and directed by this man, multi-Oscar winner Joseph L. Mankiewicz, who also wrote the screenplay from Green's novel. And Green loathed, abhorred, detested the end product. The film, he said, Green, was a real piece of political dishonesty. Mankiewicz, he said, had effected a political somersault. Quote from Green, "The American became very wise and the Englishman completely the fool of the communists." Again and again he comes back to this. As late as the 1980s, not long before he died, you could still find Green smarting over what he called Mankiewicz's appalling betrayal. "In transforming my novel into a propaganda film for America in Vietnam when it had been an attack on the American influences in Vietnam." 1980s. Interestingly, though, when I was putting this together, I discovered that Green's abhorrence and animus towards this film, though genuine, took a little bit of time to root. To begin with, in the mid-50s, he had been perfectly happy to sell the film rights to to Joseph Mankiewicz. And Green was also realistic about what might happen next. When you sell a book to Hollywood, he wrote in the 50s, you sell it outright. The film producer can alter anything. In the specific case of The Quiet American, Green was pragmatic to begin with. Why should one complain? The money enabled one to go on writing. Well, the money came from the sale in 1956 of the film rights to Mankiewicz and Mankiewicz's production company, Figaro Incorporated. For, you know, you can do these little inflation calculator things on the internet. I think it might be around $600,000. Richard may have a different view on that, but I've done a little calculation there. But it was a significant sum. In truth, Green didn't need the money to go on writing. Mike, you alluded to it last night. He had a different purpose in mind. He saw the money helping his daughter Caroline, then in her 20s, I guess, fulfill her dream of buying a ranch in Canada. Now, compared with that Caroline-related priority, Green didn't seem to give much thought to what a film version of his novel might actually look like. Sealing the deal was the thing. He knew Mankiewicz, and of course, Green would know Mankiewicz. I mean, Green and cinema are, you know, conjoined almost. He knew Mankiewicz by reputation as a, quote, bold and independent producer. And so, again quoting Green, I hoped for the best. Now, Green held to that outlook even when, later in 1956, reports began to filter to him of a very worrying gap, a Grand Canyon of a gap, actually, between his novel and Mankiewicz's emerging treatment. At the start of 1956, Mankiewicz had gone to Saigon to scout locations for the movie he wanted to make. And while he was there, he met, amongst other people, this gentleman in the middle and on that side. This is a man called René Berval. René Berval was a good friend of Green's from Green's time in Vietnam. He was the editor of a journal called France Assis. And the picture in the middle is René Berval and his Vietnamese partner, whose name, audience participation, Karina, where are you, happens to be Fong. Interesting, yeah. Well, Berval skimmed the Mankiewicz treatment. Mankiewicz dangled it in front of him and then wrote in outrage to Green, warning him of terrible things afoot. And Green finally replied in August 1956, and he was unfazed. I refuse to be distressed by what Mankiewicz does with The Quiet American. I sold it with my eyes open with one intention, and that was procuring a ranch in Canada for my daughter. That has been accomplished. And the film will soon be forgotten. I hope sooner than the book. Well, I think he was right on that, despite my efforts this morning to resurrect the film, and indeed Mike showing it last night. I think, yeah. Read the novel. Okay. Mankiewicz returned to South Vietnam a year later, start of 1957. There's Mankiewicz over my right shoulder. But this time he came armed with a big film crew for a two-month location shoot, January 1957. And as soon as the cameras rolled, it was clear that René Berval's upset was warranted. Mankiewicz was totally flipping over the political thrust of the novel. Privately, Mankiewicz thought Graham Greene's book, and I quote, a terribly distorted kind of cheap melodrama in which the American was the most idiotic kind of villain. There was a film Mankiewicz was certain from the moment he encountered the novel, but only if Fowler became the idiotic villain. British actor Michael Redgrave, there he is, you can see him on, just get my bearings, there he is to my left, classically trained, brilliant, was cast as Fowler, while the part, and I underline the word, the part of Pyle went to Audie Murphy. Except that those of you who saw it last night, maybe you noticed or didn't, The word Pyle or Alden is never uttered throughout the 1 hour and 58 minutes of the film. He's referred to as the American, even in the credits at the end. The American, Audie Murphy. It is rather early in the morning to talk of crude things, but apparently Joseph Mankiewicz thought the word pile was too suggestive of a pain in the rear end and preferred the American. Audie Murphy played the part then of the American. Audie Murphy was at the height of his popularity, really. America's most decorated soldier of World War II, a genuine war hero. He'd entered the movies in 1948, and he'd had great success, usually as a kind of, formulaic action man, mostly in westerns. But apparently, this is Murphy, tired of co-starring with horses, he thought he'd extend his range a little bit, and so he gets the role. In the Q&A at the end, I can tell you about the original casting Mankiewicz wanted. But now, interestingly, Graham Greene's novel, The Quiet American, had been banned in South Vietnam shortly after publication for being pro-communist. So what, you could legitimately ask, did President of South Vietnam, Ngo Dinh Diem, well, what was Diem doing allowing a movie of a banned book to be made in his country? And the answer to that question, according to a report in the London Times that came out just as the movie began to be shot, so that's January 1957, according to the Times, the general theme of the film will bear little relation to that of the book. Hollywood's version will be a safe one, that of the triumphant emergence of the democratic forces in the young and independent state of Vietnam, backed by the United States. In other words, PR puff for nation building. And Green, through his friend René Berval, sadly knew that to be true. Terrible reports of the changes made reach me, he wrote to Michael Redgrave. Graham Greene wasn't unfazed anymore. But what could he do? A year on, start of 1958, The Quiet American had its cinematic release, and Graham Greene duly pronounced it, as Mike Hill duly pronounced it last night, a complete travesty. That's not your view, Mike. You quoted Greene on that one, a complete travesty. Especially the ending, the final 10 minutes or so, when Fowler is exposed as a fool, tool of the communists, and a jealous, lovelorn old fool to boot. UK reviewers tended to largely agree with Green. Dillis Powell in the Sunday Times famously wrote of the cinematic assassination of the novel. In the USA, which was probably the target market, box office returns were disappointing. Most moviegoers seem to have found the film, whatever you did last night, relatively light on excitement, but very dialogue heavy, with quite a bit of puzzling Vietnamese politics thrown in. Now, in the decades since 1958, cultural commentators, historians, literary critics, biographers even, have tended to explain Green's unhappiness in terms of that Pyle, Fowler, flip over, with Pyle emerging basically the hero, Fowler diminished and demeaned and humiliated at the end. And you know, that for Green definitely rankled. But letting the historian in me have free range, I think it's another Mankiewicz distortion that ensured that Green's dislike remained at a very high pitch right through really to the end of his life. And that was the film's illusions, and blink and you'll miss them, but Graham Greene didn't miss them, the film's allusions to the then 1957-58 government of South Vietnam and to its leader Ngo Dinh Diem. The allusions, in other words, in the film to the actual Saigon government as somehow popular and democratic. For Graham Greene, that aspect of the film represented a fiction outstripping anything that he put in his novel in the first place. The time has come to introduce Diem to you properly. Ngo Dinh Diem was born in central Vietnam in 1901. He went to university, he graduated, and like so many Vietnamese graduates, he got sucked into the French colonial bureaucracy and structures until his nationalist, patriotic conscience, which was pretty big, revolted, and he walked away from that. Later, Diem's pronounced Catholicism, devout Catholicism, his anti-communism, meant that he was never going to collaborate with Ho Chi Minh and the communist-led Viet Minh. Instead, this man here will go into exile in the late 1940s. But he will return to Vietnam in 1954 when French power is really, you know, they're circling the plug hole. They're going down. And it is Diem here who will emerge as the leader of post-partition South Vietnam. And it is Diem who the Americans will regard as the true leader of the third force, the man they will hang their nation-building policy on. By 1956-57, when the movie is being contemplated and then made, the US government of Republican Dwight D. Eisenhower is building up Diem as almost an Asian Cold War superhero. Eisenhower, Mrs. Eisenhower in public, called Diem here a man who embodied the highest qualities of heroism and statesmanship. And this line was echoed in the US media in the late 50s. Let me give you some examples. Diem, the symbol of free Asia, Washington Post. Diem, the miracle man of Vietnam, Time magazine, and so on and so forth. Diem here is not mentioned, obviously, directly in the film. The action in the film, as it is in the novel, is 1951-52. That's before Diem, anyway, came to power. But you may recall, at one point, Mankiewicz gives Pyle an interesting monologue in which he reminisces to Fowler of meeting, quote, a prominent Vietnamese living in exile in New Jersey, and I stress New Jersey for a moment. If all goes well, the American in the film says, if Vietnam becomes an independent republic, this man will be its leader. His contacts with Tay in the film, Audie Murphy says, is about testing Tay's loyalty should this man come to lead. Well, you know, I don't think American audiences, such as they were, could miss the allusion there, could miss the link between a cinematic Vietnamese messiah in waiting with the real-life Ngo Dinh Diem. And that is because just 6 months before that film was released, Diem was given saturation media coverage on an official visit to the USA. He addresses a joint session of the US Congress. He is feted by Eisenhower. And as we see on the right of the screen as you view it, there was even a staged Diem homecoming to the Mary Knoll Catholic Seminary in Lakewood, New Jersey, where Diem had spent 1951 to 53 as part of his exile, and where Diem himself claimed to have developed a, quote, clear vision of my plan to bring freedom to my people. Graham Greene at this time failed to recognize the Diem of US propaganda. When Greene looked at Vietnam, 1956-57, he saw, in his own words, an inefficient dictatorship, newspapers suppressed, strict censorship, men exiled by administrative order and not by judgment of the courts. He saw something else. And historians like Seth Jacobs and Ed Miller and Jessica Chapman, Diem is a growth area in Vietnamese studies, they will confirm to you, should you read them, that Greene's version of South Vietnam was much more accurate than the Eisenhower administration's PR fairy tale. And those same historians accept now that the USA at the time did not link itself to Diem because of his democratic credentials. He didn't really have any. But really because in Cold War terms, he was a reliable hammer of the Reds. At the risk of oversimplifying, at this stage of the Cold War in the developing world, a hardline anti-communist who was a bit rubbish at democracy was far better from a US standpoint than a really brilliant Democrat who was just no good as an anti-communist. Except that for domestic and international purposes, the United States sometimes had to dress up slightly dubious allies as champions of democracy, and so it was with Diem. But behind the PR screen, as Green knew, South Vietnam by the mid to late 50s had descended into a dictatorship. It was a police state in which not just communists, but any critics of the government risked incarceration or something worse, in what Green himself later called, quote unquote, a Diem terror, unquote. Green met Diem once only in February 1955. Diem declared himself a Green fan and chatted for quite a long time about some of Green's novels, although he didn't mention the one he'd banned. Didn't take to him was Green's immediate reaction in his journal. A near madman was his later, more considered view. Now, that 1955 visit when Green met Diem proved to be his last ever to Vietnam. But later in 1955, Green published a series of newspaper articles about South Vietnam. Now, if The Quiet American, the novel, not the film, is regarded, I think rightly, as prophetic, I think people need to look at Green's 1955 Vietnam journalism a bit as well, because that's pretty prophetic as it applies to Ngo Dinh Diem. Here's an example. In the Sunday Times in May 1955, Green held forth on Diem's flaws. This is just a montage of images I picked up along the way of Green's various stays in Vietnam. But he mapped some of Diem's flaws in May 1955. He talked about his dictatorial instincts, his inflexibility, his insularity, his nepotism, his blatant favouring of the Catholic minority over the greater, much greater Buddhist majority, and his reliance on the Americans, obvious reliance, at the cost of damage to his reputation as an independent-minded nationalist. This is Green on Diem. There he is, he said. He's separated from the people by cardinals and police cars with wailing sirens and foreign advisers droning on about global strategy when he should be walking the rice fields unprotected, learning the hard way how to be loved and obeyed. The two cannot be separated. One pictured him there in the presidential palace, sitting with his blank gaze, incorruptible, obstinate, ill-advised, going to his weekly confession, bolstered by his belief that God is always on the Catholic side, waiting for a miracle. The name I would write under his portrait is the patriot ruined by the West. In another article, in the New Republic in 1955, Green argued that it wasn't just Diem's reliance on American political and military advisers that were doing him damage. Equally problematic, felt Green, the Roman Catholic, was the way prominent American Roman Catholics were setting Diem up as a Christian crusader in a war against the godless barbarianism of communism. Here is Diem again a little later than 1955 with that most political of cardinals, Francis Spellman. Now, this worried Green. Green noted there was already, in the mid to late 50s, a strain of anti-Americanism abroad in South Vietnam. And he worried that if that was to acquire an anti-Catholic complexion, you could have the makings in South Vietnam of a war of religion. US-backed Catholic minority against the Buddhist majority. And if you know much about what happens to Vietnam in the early 60s, I said it was prophetic. Now, Graham Greene was kept regularly updated on the reality of life in South Vietnam by René Berval. You'll remember René from earlier, and his Vietnamese partner, Nguyen Thi Phong. Greene's affection for this couple is lay bare in the frontispiece of his novel. Dear René and Fong, I've asked permission to dedicate this book to you, not only in memory of the happy evenings I've spent with you in Saigon over the last 5 years, but also because I have quite shamelessly borrowed the location of your flat to house one of my characters, and your name, Fong, for the convenience of readers, because it is simple, beautiful, and easy to pronounce. But Green soon grew anxious for his friends trapped inside Diem's unforgiving South Vietnam. My dearest Graham, Berval wrote to him in August 1955, you cannot ever in your worst nightmares imagine what this country is looking like just now. Fascism, police, terror everywhere, as it has never been, even in Germany. As far as I'm concerned, I'm in a very bad position. Asia, my magazine, in English and Chinese, is dead, and he, meaning Diem, has suppressed the 800 official subscriptions. Furthermore, I have already 6 or 7 times been threatened with death. As this damned people, and he meant the regime, are able to do what would never come into a normal brain, I have been obliged to send Fong to her family for the time being. I am not at all afraid for me personally, but they are able to do her some bad to hurt me. The situation, and there's plenty of letters. These letters, Nick, are in Boston College, just to go back to what you were saying yesterday. There's loads of these. The situation didn't improve. And the couple then decided to try and move to Cambodia. And Green was so relieved. He said, there at least, he wrote to Fong, you should be safe from Mr. Diem and his minions. But the move fell through, and Green was crestfallen. I do wish you could leave a country now which has become so unsympathetic to everything one loves. Hold that there. There was a gala premiere of the movie The Quiet American, general release in February 58, but in January 58 in Washington, D.C., a gala premiere. Graham Greene didn't attend, it won't surprise you. But what he learned of this event made him livid. The premiere, you see, was an unashamedly pro-Diem affair. It was organized by the so-called American Friends of Vietnam, the AFV, sometimes known as the Vietnam Lobby. It was really a Diem fan club. Now, the American Friends of Vietnam included really prominent American Roman Catholics, including a future US president known as John F. Kennedy. It included also high-ranking politicians, Democrat and Republican, leaving religion aside, who were ardent Cold Warriors and who lionized Diem as this great Cold Warrior. It also included the man standing up, for example, people like Henry R. Luce, the publishing magnate. We now use the word influencer, wouldn't we? Massive influence. That's Luce standing next to Diem at a dinner in Diem's honor when he was in America in 1957. So the premiere was an AFV-sponsored event. I should have added, there's somebody else who was a member of the AFV, a film director by the name of Joseph L. Mankiewicz. In the film, Mankiewicz makes Pyle, or the Pyle character, a member of a similar-sounding organization, the Friends for Free Asia. But Mankiewicz also added at the end this dedication. You'll have seen it if you saw the movie last night. To the people of the Southern Republic of Vietnam, to their chosen president and administration, our appreciation for their help and kindness. That really got to Graham Greene. This contemporizing of his novel and of the early 50s. Just for the record, by the way, Diem had been chosen in a presidential election in South Vietnam in October 1955, when Diem won a, I don't know about you, but I find it a slightly dodgy 98.2% of all votes cast, including 200,000 more votes in Saigon than there were people registered on the electoral roll. No wonder then, as Michael Redgrave remembers, Graham Greene had to, quote, almost be forcibly tied down when he learned that all the money from that gala premiere went into Nodin Ziem's pockets. When Greene himself calmed down, he remarked on the added irony of Ziem's windfall, since it had been far from my thoughts when I wrote The Quiet American that I would prove a financial benefit to one of the most corrupt governments in Southeast Asia. Well, as I mentioned some time ago now, and I'm nearly done, folks, most explanations for Greene's enduring unhappiness towards this movie center on the Pyle Fowler flipover and the offending final reel, as Pauline Kael called it. To that standard explanation, I think it's correct. I really think we need to add what I'd call the Ziem factor. And Greene's revulsion at the way a film that was born of his literary genius ended up giving public endorsement and financial succor to a detested government. Look, let me wrap up quickly, beginning with what were Greene's thoughts on a remake? If he didn't like that one, did he want a better version? And you know, there weren't many thoughts until 1983, when a young friend, a great admirer of the novel, by the name of Peter Palliser, produced a new screen treatment just off his own bat, sent it to Greene, and Greene liked it. He called it excellent. And some momentum began to be generated towards a remake, 1983. Graham Greene even took the initiative in writing himself to the actor he thought was the perfect Thomas Fowler. Oh, audience participation. I just wonder who you might think Graham Greene thought in 1983 might be. Mike may well know. Keep quiet. Richard might know. Any thoughts on who he might think would be the perfect actor? It's like one of my seminars. Nobody's answering the question. Sean. Sean Connery. He wrote as follows to Sean Connery. The original film of Mankiewicz was a complete betrayal of the book, and I'm anxious to see a proper film made. As for Fowler, I can think of no actor that could play the part nearly as well as you. Sean Connery was interested. He asked to see the script. A director was appointed. It got that far. The director was Charles Sturridge, who in 1981 had directed the Granada television super acclaimed, rightfully so, production of Evelyn Waugh's Brideshead Revisited. And then, for reasons I can't find in any of the Greene archives, the project collapsed, went nowhere. I don't know why. I think it's a great shame. Maybe that's showbiz. Greene died in 1991, and it would be another decade before a successor to the Mankiewicz movie hit the big screen. This one was directed, as I said at the start, by the Australian Philip Noyce, and saw Michael Caine, not Sean Connery, playing Fowler. I quite like the version. I think Michael Caine usually does versions of Michael Caine in most of his movies, but I think this was, I think this is one of his best performances. And I think Greene would have liked it, at least because it was more faithful to that trajectory, political trajectory of the novel. But I hope you'll forgive me, even if the puff said I'd say a bit more about this movie than I have. I thought I want to talk about the movie Greene saw and the movie that Greene expressed himself about rather than the one that was made after he died. The last words will go not to Greene or me as such, but to Gillian Sutro. That's Gillian, probably a picture from the late 1940s. Friend of Graham Greene and her husband John Sutro, very good friends. Gillian Sutro, many, many years later, felt that Graham Greene had learned an important lesson from the Mankiewicz experience. Quote, Graham understood at last that when one sells one's book at a good price, with no clause concerning script approval, and she underlines that, one has, so to speak, cooked one's goose. The Quiet American, after The Quiet American, Graham became very tiresome concerning script and cast approval in return for receiving less money. One can't get it both ways with Americans. Graham would have liked to have both the lolly and the power. Now, I think that's a fantastic phrase, the lolly and the power. I could almost, at a stretch, imagine it on the cover of a Graham Greene novel. Yeah, the lolly and the power. You know, when I started, when I came up with the title, I thought I was being really clever. You know, shooting Alden Pyle, film assassination. Well, it turns out in the novel, Alden Pyle was done in with a rusty bayonet and probably drowned as well. So I got that one completely wrong. Now I think I should have called the talk The Quiet American, The Lolly and the Power. But that phrase will just be my sign-off. So thank you for listening.
Kevin, thank you for a terrific presentation. You always open our eyes to all vistas of things that we didn't know. And I'm just wondering, do people have some questions? We have a few minutes that Kevin can respond.
What happened to Fong and her husband in the end?
I was going to ask if Crana knows herself. I don't know. That is, this. I'm in the foothills of projects relating to this. René Berval was still writing to Green from Vietnam, South Vietnam, by 1960-61, and then the letter trail goes dead. And it's very hard to actually get to grips with these people. They seem to sort of just drop out of history a little bit. But that's one of my to-do things. I need to track down what happened to René Berval. But even harder, and Crana, you may have tried yourself, is to track down what happened to the real Fong. You didn't manage that either. No. So I guess, as the historian in me thinks, that imperfect as it is, I mean, the perfect solution would be to be able to give a big sketch of what happened to all these people. Since we can't do that, the very least we can do is give them a moment and give them a voice, at least for a moment. Because they were very important to Graham Greene at the time. And his animus towards that film, I think, was very significantly influenced by what he knew to be the reality of South Vietnam, and he knew that reality because he knew René Berval and he knew Fong. You can boom. Yeah. Well, I don't know. You were at the film, I believe, last night, weren't you? What did you think of Audie Murphy's performance?
I had that comment in my mind all the way through, which made it quite difficult to be objective about it. He didn't entirely convince.
So, Mike basically spoiled the film for you?
Good.
Okay. The other thing is, an experienced seminar leader, you see, the student just asked me a question I didn't know the answer of immediately, and so to buy myself time, I asked him what he thought. So I now know my answer to that to that question. Michael Redgrave struggled with Audie Murphy. He struggled with him because he was a limited actor. Gene did notice that Audie Murphy did blink, despite some people. Michael Redgrave having to go to the director at one point and say, "Do you think you could ask Murphy to blink occasionally?" It's very difficult to have these intense. He's staring like this. People who are cruel about Murphy's acting would say, well, why would a plank of wood blink? But Gene definitely noticed some blinking going on. I think Redgrave, classically trained actor, struggled from that point of view. I think he was a bit weirded out by Audie Murphy as well, who used to sleep with a couple of pistols under his pillow and a bunch of ammunition and stuff, because even though ostensibly South Vietnam was at peace, you know, what will become the Viet Cong later were beginning to get active. I don't know if I think I alluded to it earlier, but these two were not the originals that Mankiewicz wanted. Mankiewicz wanted Laurence Olivier in the first instance to play Fowler, and Olivier was seriously interested, but Olivier said, "I want my friend Montgomery Clift to play the Quiet American character, the Pyle character." And then, I don't know if you know anything about this period in film history, but Montgomery Clift was
interested, but he had a terrible car crash and he was wired up and he had other things going on in his life. So he walks away, and then Mankiewicz chooses Audie Murphy, at which point Olivier walks away because Olivier doesn't want to work with Audie Murphy. And Olivier, interestingly, had also, and there's some lovely correspondence between Olivier and Mankiewicz, because Mankiewicz is giving him the screenplay, and at one point Olivier writes to Mankiewicz. He says, I don't want to act with Murphy, and by the way, I'm not liking the script anymore. Is your aim to, quote, go after Green, unquote? He said, I'm not having it. And so he walked away, and Redgrave comes in, Audie Murphy comes in.
Can I just follow that up? I put my hand up because I was going to make a comment that actually relates to what Rob has just asked you, Kevin, which is, you're going to find this a bit dumb as a suggestion, but it strikes me as possibly an appropriate irony, if that's the right word. If you compare Audie Murphy with Brendan Fraser in the two versions, Brendan Fraser is now an Oscar-winning actor. He's very good as Pyle in the Michael Caine version. And in some ways, it's appropriate that you get a nuanced performance in that as Pyle by Fraser for somebody who is duplicitous, has hidden depths, etc. Conversely, in the 1958 version, we've got a quiet American who also turns out to be a kind of guileless, innocent American, and quite unwittingly, because he was an amateur actor who's very wooden, in some ways it's appropriate that Audie Murphy was like that for a guy who is, as it says on the tin, what you see is what you get. In some ways, the performances are quite appropriate to the take on the tale that you get in the two films. Does that make sense?
No, that's not a frivolous point at all, Mike. I think that's a really measured and well-drawn observation. Mankiewicz himself, because there was a lot of flack he knew coming Audie Murphy's way, said that Audie Murphy was absolutely perfect for what he wanted to represent. So that links perfectly with your sense of it. I think Brendan Fraser is a large unit, as we say of certain sports people. He's a large unit. There were some comic moments, I have to say, with the giant who was Michael Redgrave being fireman lifted by the more diminutive Audie Murphy. But yeah, I think they are in a sense perfect for their times. Of course, the 2002 version was ready for release in 2001, and then 9/11 happened, and so the film distributors held it back because they didn't feel the United States, never mind an international audience, the US audiences, were not ready for a major motion picture that showed, should we say, American interventionism in some form in a developing world situation, and showed America in a kind of negative light at times, given the zeitgeist of the terrible stuff that was coming its way as a result of what happened to the Twin Towers. So you can contemporize in both senses. So I suggested that the 1958 movie is a handy tool for the cultural Cold War historian. I think the way that 2002 movie ends up, released in 2002, and other things that are going on with it, are emblematic as well. You know, there's a snapshot in time going on in that movie, just as there is in the 1958 movie. And as I say, I keep coming back, being apologetic. It's a Graham Greene festival. I decided to talk about stuff that he commented on rather than second guess what he might have said about that second movie. But the second movie is certainly well worth.
Thank you so much, Kevin. That's a magnificent presentation, and I'll praise you more when we're having coffee, which is now, by the way. So
thank you very much.
Coffee over here.